guys, the most important thing a manager does for his or her company is effective hiring. Effective hiring makes managing that much easier. And most managers don't know how to hire. They don't know how to structure an interview. They don't know how to ask questions. And they don't know how to listen and take notes and make a determination. At our Effective Interviewer Conference, we'll teach you how to structure your day, how to structure each interview, how to structure questions, how to ask the questions, how to listen to answers, how to take notes, and how to follow up to make sure you're making the right call. All in manager tool style, which is to say practice, 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 practice. Please come see us at the website and look up the Effective Interviewer Conference. Come to a city in the United States and Europe soon.
Welcome to Manager Tools. How to Respond to a Departure, Chapter 1, Don't Hire. Here we go. Okay, I have an opening. And as soon as I get an opening, somebody quits or somebody leaves for some reason, man, I got to hire that person. Got to do it. Don't want to lose that spot.
How do I do it? And new managers, like, how do I do it? Who do I talk to? How do I get approval? What does open rec mean? Is it open WRECK? Is it people right. have no idea. Yeah.
Right. And there's an easier way.
Right. Yeah. It is common for managers to assume I've lost someone, so therefore I should hire. And one of the biggest gripe sessions that managers have is when they lose someone and the organization is not doing well for whatever reason. And so they're told, yeah, you may not be able to get an open rec, which, by the way, rec is REQ, which stands for requisition, the ability to hire. And it involves HR and your boss too, as well, unless you're more senior than a frontline manager. But there's a completely different way of thinking about this. And it's the difference between being a manager and being a leader, or manager and executive, depending upon, you know, choose your term. And hiring may become necessary, but the first thing that smart managers do is they don't make getting hiring approval the first step in the process. They actually step back and our second point is they assume they can't fill the slot. And then what they do is something that will surprise a lot of you. We attempt to fit the work we have to people, which are the costs, rather than fitting people to the work. We don't assume the work stays static, since the people don't. What we say is, okay, we've got a certain number of people. What work may not need to be done? And this is a fundamental divide between most managers and effective managers, or most managers and definitely executives.
Right.
Executives see this as an opportunity to save money, and most managers see it as a desperate need to fill the slot so that everybody doesn't start complaining about the workload.
Right. Yeah. So first thing is, don't make hiring approval your first step. And I agree with you. I really think it is a difference between the way a manager thinks and an executive. I think there's a clear distinction there, because the difference is a manager thinking in some regards is, I got a bunch of work to do. I have a kind of a set of resources, a set process, and I'm just a machine.
And the fear of the work not getting done is a fundamental driver, right?
Right.
So therefore, losing somebody makes that fear even bigger. Fear narrows your decision-making process. And so therefore, you're thinking, well, of course, then I got to hire. I've got to replace the person.
Right.
Even though everybody knows that that during the time you're trying to hire, the work's not getting done, and nobody's head is getting chopped off during that time. And in addition, there's no way that day one, the new person, is going to be as good as the person you just lost. It's just not. And so you're going to go through a long period where the ability to get work done is going to be reduced. But nobody thinks about that. The fear of losing somebody crazy.
Right. Yeah, it just goes crazy. And under those circumstances, in my experience, that's where the worst hires actually occur. Because I'm under stress, right? I feel like I have to hire somebody. And so I settle for somebody less than I normally would. And it's just a bad thing. So stepping back from that and not immediately hiring somebody or asking for approval to hire is a good step.
The way I would say it is, to an executive, there's nothing wrong with hiring someone. It may, in fact, be a completely reasonable thing to do. But there is something very wrong with hiring reflexively, meaning it's my reflex. I lost a person, I'm going to hire. If you work for a smart director, and again, folks, for those of you who don't know, director means manager of managers. If you say, well, I've got to hire somebody, and you go to your boss, your director, she's going to ask you a few questions when you have an opening. And one of the first questions she's going to ask is, did you consider not filling the job?
No.
And you say no. But in your head, you're like, huh? Why am I getting that? I mean, this is an assumption. This is a given. Everyone knows this, right? In fact, whenever you say everyone knows it, it just tells you it's an assumption you have. Okay. And then when your boss says, why not? You say, I don't know. I just assumed we had an opening. So it was time to hire. We have tons of work to do, right? I got to tell you, to your boss, the director, that scenario doesn't make you seem like a creative thinker or a manager who thinks about their larger role in the organization. That manager in that situation is thinking about himself. And the director is thinking, he's not a big picture guy. He's a cog in the system. He's doing his little job. He lost a person. And so he feels the need to engage in hiring somebody else. And I got to tell you, for some managers working for some higher thinking executives, they're going to think, you know, low likelihood of upper potential for this manager is being selfish, is not thinking about it in a positive way, is maybe this is an opportunity to get rid of some work.
That's right.
And save the salary of the person we lost.
Because that's what the executive is thinking. It's not a spot to be filled. To her, it's like, oh, here's an opportunity for cost savings.
Yeah, it's a cost savings in the form of less salary, right? It's an opportunity to be creative. It's an opportunity to reexamine the work that's being done and who's doing it. Maybe there's a way to get the really important work done without hiring. Maybe we can agree to let some things go and get everyone focused on what really matters. And look, guys, this is not the time to invoke some sort of hackneyed idea about rapacious executives always expecting less and less people to do more and more. Yeah, that happens, but it gets reported on whenever it does happen. And so therefore it appears much more common than it actually is. And it's reported on because it's dramatic. This isn't a question of seeing your leaders as evil. As managers, our first responsibility is to the organization, not to our team, not to them getting their work done. So our first steps should be to get what the organization wants. Going and getting hiring approval right away, first thing you do, is actually backwards. And actually, hiring approval will be granted more readily to the guy who can show that he's done the proper due diligence on the work, its value, the people, the cost, before he asks to open a requisition. So, wait. It's not our first choice.
Yeah. I'll tell you what, in my executive experience, there was a period of my time, at a fairly large organization where I spent a lot of time amassing a large organization.
You did. I remember. I did.
And
we talked about it. Yeah.
Right. And folks thought of it as, I mean, my peers thought, oh man, he's going somewhere. Right. And I found out, and later on, I just realized it was stupid, right? And I started giving away pieces of the organization or figure out, hey, we don't need to do that anymore. And I tell you what, I got a lot more cred with
senior
my boss,
people.
Right? When I started engaging that behavior.
Yeah.
Okay, so I think the next step is like, assume you cannot fill the slot, right?
Yeah, we start with assuming you can't, that they won't let us. In other words, if you have that assumption, if you couldn't get approval, now you have a different problem. And the question you start asking is, how do I solve the problem of this much work and only this many people? The problem is no longer the request to hire, the sourcing, the screening, the interviewing, the HR person that you don't know but you wish you did because he or she has control over the rack. The problem is how to get the most out of whom you have, because whom you have is all you have.
Yeah. And that's a better problem to be thinking about, frankly.
Yeah. And look, this happens all the time, of course, that you cannot hire. Okay. But everybody forgets that too easily. Openings happen during layoffs and downturns. And in those times, authority to hire is routinely denied, right? A manager who assumes her first action is to hire because her problem is, quote, not enough people all of a sudden, just is not going to feel terribly creative about solving the other problem. What's the right way to do our job with the people we have? Because by the way, before you lost that person, that was your question as well. What's the right way to get our work done with the people we have? Now you have a different number of people. That's the variable. And so you say, okay, I have less people. Therefore, what am I going to do about the work?
Well, and the fact is, right now, you have less people and you still have to get the job done. Mm-hmm. So you're already doing it to some extent, right?
Yeah, because if the problem really is not enough people to do the work, the work is the static force, the immovable object. That's the given, because in your mind, the solution is more people. If that assumption that the work can't change stays in the manager's mind, she's going to be a lousy leader of solving the problem. So look, to avoid wasting time thinking about what we can't have we cross the Rubicon. We burn our ships. We assume we'll not get anyone new. It's just a different problem to solve, but it's the problem executives want us to solve, not the one that there is an established protocol for. If I'm a manager and I lose somebody, there's an established protocol that I can follow, a process. You can call somebody in HR, call your boss. Hey, how do I get an open rec? What do I need to do? Okay.
Yeah.
And for a lot of managers, that's easier. Okay, there's a process. I don't really know how to do it. I'm not really sure I'm good at it. And most managers aren't terribly good at sourcing and interviewing and so on and hiring. But separate from that, you can do that. There's a way to follow that along. Choosing this other choice, the executive choice, the leader choice, and saying, I'm not going to hire. How do I do that? Most people don't want to do it because what do we fear? We fear, our biggest right. fear is being in trouble for not getting our work done.
Yeah. And taking this attitude, I think, sets you up. You develop a skill. Doing what we're talking about here is a skill just like any other managerial or executive skill. And the fact is, sometimes you're going to have no choice but to follow this process. Yeah. Like during a layoff, for example. Yeah. So, like, figure it out now.
Exactly. The idea that, oh, well, by definition, you always get an open rec. No, that's not by definition. Sometimes that's not true. And like you said, you might as well learn it now. Right. If you can figure out how to do essentially the same amount of work, and I put quotes around that, with less people, you're going to be seen as somebody who increases productivity, because that's the definition of increased right. productivity. Really, what we're implying is that all of our definition of our own work or how much work we have is really misleading. We'll talk about this later, but 30% of the work you and your team are doing is waste.
That's
and
right.
my definition of waste, which is an oversimplification, is not fair, and you could quibble about it, but in general, it's true, is that waste is anything that if you stop doing it, nobody gets in trouble. Hmm. And your boss simply doesn't know everything you're doing or not doing.
Yeah.
There are probably a few things you absolutely have to do, and there's a bunch of other stuff. There are reports that are being done. There are meetings that are being done. There's all kinds of things you could just not do.
Right. And we do it all the time. Matter of fact, the next couple of weeks, I'm going to do that on the finance side. We're a very small team. I think if people realize how much work we do relative to the number of people we have, it's huge. We're very, very productive. And every 6 months, every year, we're sitting down talking, okay, what can we stop doing? What do we need to eliminate?
And we look around and it's stuff that's really obvious. Oh, we don't have to do that anymore. How did we not even recognize that 3 months
ago? Because we're idiots. Because right. we're not very smart.
Right. We're not smart. So look, if you can't fill the slot, that's the assumption. Basically, you got two choices. Get more work out of the existing team or figure out what work not to do. And the most likely solution, folks, is to include some of both of that. But the big part is just recognizing there's some work that people are doing that adds no value, but it still takes time and we need to get rid of it. So that brings us to our sort of the nitty-gritty guidance, which is you start thinking about fitting the work to the people. Assuming the people are now static, you've lost a person, you used to have 4 and 5 and now you have 4, not rather saying the work has to get done. I need as many people as I need to in order to get that work done. The people and the costs are now fixed because we have less rather than the work being fixed. So we assume we have all the people we're going to get. There's less people now to do the same amount of work. That means either people are going to simply take on additional work, adding more hours, being more efficient, or some of the work that has been being done for a while is no longer going to get done. And look, guys, if you assume for a moment that the general refrain of I'm so swamped, no time, can't breathe, overwhelmed, I'm overwhelmed is true, then it's unlikely you're going to be able to spread the work around to everyone else and expect them to work more hours. For the record, though, guys, we will say I'm so swamped isn't really true at all, but folks believe it is. So they're prepared to double down on their belief as a protective measure. And a minor point in our guidance here is after not hiring is to not assume all that work has to be done. And the fact is,
it doesn't.
So look, think for a moment about a manager with 5 directs. Assume that compensation is 50% of his operating budget, which is a general rule of thumb. So the loss of one person, all things being equal, which they never are, is a savings of 10% of your budget. Guys, that's a serious savings. And any self-respecting manager who is presented the opportunity to figure out which work to cut back on so that you could cut your budget by 10% would jump at the opportunity. It just means you're going to get some work. You're not going to get some of the work done. So this is our opportunity to think like a leader. This is an opportunity to lean out the organization. This is exactly the opposite believe it or not, of implying that we're going to get everything done with less people. And we're just simply going to suggest that people haven't been efficient up until now. It's saying, no, I recognize my people are fully engaged. I'm going to go through and cut out the fat. And the fat is not people. It's work.
Yeah.
And guys, I think
people, a lot of managers don't feel they can do that.
The work is static. That's
the it's not a negotiation. There's no good. Right.
My boss tells me this is the work, right? It comes from my boss. It comes from the work. Yeah, absolutely.
And your boss has no idea what, right. At least 50% of what you do has no idea.
Yeah. And when you become a director and you look down and realize you trust your managers and you've got your own stuff to do and there's seven of them reporting to you, you're like, the managers think, oh, he knows everything I do. No, he doesn't. He's got his head full of other stuff.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. It's crazy. The assumptions are killing us, right?
Yes. They
are. And for the record, guys, we say us because this happened to us as well. We are managers and executives.
Oh, it's happening to me today.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Okay, so look, the best way to tell you how to do this is to follow our general guidance for what we call delegating to the floor. Okay. Here's what you do. First, you ask your directs to prioritize their work. Ask each one of them to analyze their work based on its value and priority of the organization. And the organization is them, you, the division, the firm, right? In terms of the various forces that are involved. Tell them to make a list of everything they're working on and roughly how much time it takes them. And then to rank it, not by hours, how many hours you spend, but by what they think the value is. It probably won't be more than 20 things, but it may be. If it is, there are going to be a lot of things that take very few minutes of their time. And those are probably things that won't be missed. And yes, sometimes those are things that are going to be missed, but you won't know what will be missed or what won't be missed until you have them make a list. And you can't make the list for your people. They've got to make the list for you. And I promise you, folks, if people do a reasonably good job, and let's assume for a moment they do, you're going to be shocked and even embarrassed by some of the things they spend time on. So it might sound like this. Hey, Mike says to me, or I say to Mike, hey, Mike, here's what I'd like you to do. Spend an hour today or tomorrow. Make a list of everything or nearly everything that you're working on. You can look at your calendar. You can look at your piles of work. Anything you think you can think of that'll help you think this through. I'm not going to wait, though, for a week for you to do a time diary of everything you touch in the next week. That's probably overkill. Then I want you to list all the work you do in order of importance. And next to each item you're working on, put down the amount of time you think it takes you each week. Okay. I don't want a Word document. I don't want a spreadsheet. I want it in the body of an email. I want the style of the communication with me to indicate the precision with which you did this. If you start using random number generators to check your time and so on, this is not a time study.
Right.
I want to do a broad, gross, rough cut of what it is you work on. I just want to cut at the first stuff, the obvious stuff, when we can.
Right. Yeah, and don't be surprised if you get something back that says they're working 80 hours a week.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. It's laughable. It's wrong. It doesn't prove that they're working feverishly at home at night. It means they don't have any clue about how long they spend on things. And they don't engage in normal checks for reasonableness and quality on stuff they submit, which is fine. Right. It doesn't matter.
And it's not unusual that somebody falls in that category.
No, it's normal. And here's the thing. Don't ding them for saying they work 8 hours a week. They're just protecting their addiction to food, clothing, and shelter. And really, that's not important because you're going to look at the list and realize, holy Toledo, half of this stuff, I'm just going to tell them to stop doing. The point is, when you look at the list, there's going to be pretty quickly a drop-off in terms of time spent, or more importantly, the value delivered to the organization. And you're going to be able to say, yeah, it may only be 20 or 30 hours a week, after which everything else is like kind of secondary. And we're not suggesting you cut everything off below that line necessarily. It's up to you. But you're going to find at least 10. I would suggest 20. And it's absolutely possible you'll find 30% of what they're doing. You could just literally tell them, stop doing it. But you're not going to tell them that, because our next step is you're going to ask them for a recommendation about what won't get done. After you've asked them to create the list, and it's the categorization of their time data, ask them to review the list further, think about it, and determine what on the list might could afford not being done. Yeah. So you say, look, once you've got your list, review it, analyze it a bit for me, and come back to me with a recommendation for what work you could not continue doing, or put differently, what you could stop doing. Assuming for a moment that a bunch of new high priority work is coming your way. If you had to, what would you recommend we drop just because you're not sure it's viable? If there's a report you create that you think nobody reads, or put differently, if you think everybody reads it, but you never get a question about it, because the definition of a report that gets read is one that you get questions about. If you never get a question about a report
that's
you're
a
creating.
That's a great definition. I haven't heard that before. I haven't heard you say that before. That's a great definition.
Yeah, if you don't get any questions about the report you produce, nobody's reading it. And maybe that sounds cynical, but
that's true. Yeah. Good point.
Yeah. Think about the time you could save simply not doing some stuff. And then that's what I want, a list with recommendations on it of stuff you could set aside. With the understanding, if you go lightly on the list, I may overrule you and add more to the list that you come up with.
So you're letting them make the decision to cut?
No. For frontline managers, when we're talking about individual contributors, they don't make the decision. And the reason why is if they make a decision, the decision is a choice and an action to go with it. The decision means that if Mike works for Mark and Mark says, make a recommendation and a decision and start actioning it. And then Mark's peer, Joe, comes to Mike and says, where's my stuff? Mike can't blame me for the decision.
Oh, so, I can.
Yeah. But ethically you wouldn't.
Yeah.
I trust you, partner. And so you as my direct, if you make that decision yourself early on when you're just learning how to do this kind of stuff, essentially massaging work to fit the people rather than the other way around, then you're going to be in trouble. So what we do is we teach them the process of making decisions, making recommendations, analysis, option consideration, and so on. And the manager makes the decision themselves.
That's right.
We ask for the recommendation.
Right. And you don't do it all yourself. You want them to make a recommendation.
Because there's some learning
for them, right? The direct is learning how to make decisions, even at the end they don't make the decision. Right.
Yeah. They're learning how to gather data, do analysis, consider options, make recommendations. And then as they get better and better, we can absolutely start trusting some of our better performers to start making the decision themselves. So it might sound like this, guys. Ultimately, I'm going to make the decision. If you'll do the analysis and I can feel good about it, I'll likely follow your recommendation. But this way, I'm responsible. As you get better and more confident at this kind of stuff, I'll start letting you make the decisions as well. But of course, I'll still be responsible. And then, as I just mentioned, you're going to tell them, you're going to ask them to direct questions to you, right?
Relative to work that's been cut out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The last stage is that after you make the decision, they stop working on what they recommended and you decided. When they express concerns, when somebody else expresses concern, tell them again, all questions about what they're working on come to you. If they think someone is questioning why something that used to get done is not getting done, they would tell that person to talk to you, the manager. And the fact is, in our entire history of this, I think it's happened twice that we actually heard from a manager that, oh yeah, somebody came back to me and said, there's a problem here. You know, you were doing this and now you're not anymore. And I got to tell you, we've recommended this to hundreds of thousands of managers. I think two is a rounding error and they're probably just crazy people anyway. So again, if you expect your directs to do the analysis on their own, make the decision on their own and to deal with the consequences on their own, now they're learning by trial by fire. They're not going to do what you ask. They're going to hide some work or try to get everything done, which is a complete contravention of the whole idea of this. Okay. Now, I want to mention one more thing. This guidance is largely for managers of individual contributors, not directors. If you're a director, if you're managing managers in that situation, you don't actually have to make the decision for them. A manager can make the decision themselves. They can defend themselves. Okay. On the other hand, this is for a future cast, if you are a director and you lose one of your managers, you may want to consider reorganizing. That's another technique.
Yeah.
We'll include that in our guidance for frontline managers, but it tends to be harder for frontline managers to reorganize just because there are less widgets. There are less movable parts.
Right. And the responsibilities are more singular and focused.
Yeah.
And, right.
Yeah. It's not as easy as most companies make it out to be regarding reorganizing, but directors have a great deal more leeway than most of them realize. And in most cases, your boss isn't going to care.
Well, again, I'm not replacing a manager who's more expensive. And so,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. If you can figure out a way to not replace the manager and reorganize the work.
Huge.
Yeah. And guys, we'll just mention one more thing. As an ultimate backstop to this new way of thinking where you're going to fit work to people rather than the other way around. Suppose for some reason later you're able to hire. Wouldn't you now think differently about how to employ or deploy that new person that you might be able to hire in light of your new way of looking at the workload and capacity?
Exactly. You might have a rec, but you might find you want to hire somebody with a completely different set of skills, right?
I've always been wanting to do X, and now I can hire a guy to do X.
Now you're starting to think strategically.
Exactly. That's what executives want.
Oh, and the other thing I think I gotta mention before we go is, look, if you try this and you fail, you just can't figure it out or it doesn't work out. You get credit for trying. Right? Go back to boss. Boss, I've spent the last 2 months working through this.
I was trying to figure out a way not to hire.
And I'm sorry, I can't do it. And here's what I did. Here's my analysis. And I can't make it work. And the boss can give you credit for at least trying.
And in fact, I would argue that a boss that you went to and said that rather than I need to hire, that boss is going to say, well, okay, but maybe I can help you here. You get credit for the effort.
Yeah.
And now the boss steps over the line and says, let me help you. Maybe at my level, there's a little bit ability, a little bit more flexibility, a little bit, the parameters a little bit broader, and we can actually figure out how to do it.
Maybe I can take some responsibilities off you and give it to somebody else. Yeah, or I have another person who's not.
You're not comfortable making that decision, but I am. Stop doing X.
And
the manager said, I didn't feel I could do that. But the director goes, oh God, let's stop doing that right now.
Right. I can tell you, we don't need that.
Yeah.
Or I'll go talk to Joe and I'll convince Joe that he doesn't need that report. Right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, summarizing, guys, when you lose somebody, don't immediately jump to rehiring. Think first about cutting out some work that doesn't add value. And by the way, we're not saying it adds no value, but it adds less value than other work that we'd rather spend more time on. And remember, the general rule is 30% of what we do is waste.
Awesome. Thanks, my friend.
Anytime, partner.
Thanks, everyone. That's it. We'll see you next week. Have a great one. So long.
This podcast was produced by Manager Tools. Manager Tools creates actionable management guidance every single week. To receive additional materials via our newsletter and to find products for situations you may face as a manager or professional, go to www.manager-tools.com. Search for Manager Tools on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn.